All right, good morning. That's different. It's 11:22, Wednesday, November 6th. This is the TDN Writers Room podcast. I am Joe Bianco, associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Alan Carrasco, managing editor of the TDN. And thanks to Joe, who's back in the chair this week after being at Santa Anita.
You didn't like the job I did last week?
You did a great job, though.
Okay. It kind of sounded like, thank God Joe's back. Get rid of that Finley guy.
More importantly, Joe's on about 6 hours sleep after putting out last night's massive Phasic Tipton paper. So great.
Thank you,
Al. Great job on that, Joe.
Thank you. I didn't want to bring it up myself and sound like a victim. So we have a sponsored guest this week. It's the Green Group guest of the week. Friend of the show, John Green, and his father, Len, have a tax accounting firm, and they will be sponsoring the guests going forward. This week, we have Todd Pletcher. So I don't know who better you could get after his win in the Breeders' Cup Classic with Vino Rosso. So stick around and listen through, and you'll hear Todd Pletcher on pretty much everything. He gave us some great stuff. So this is our newly sponsored Green Group Guest of the Week. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by the Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With more than 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com, www.greenco.com. We're joined this week by a big get, Mr. Todd Pletcher, who obviously had the big win in the Breeders' Cup Classic over the weekend with Vino Rosso. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're obviously a guy who's done a ton in his career, Hall of Fame career. And it seems like at this point you're really checking off things that you haven't accomplished yet. And I remember when you won your first Derby. Can you compare that feeling to what you felt Saturday when you won your first Breeders' Cup Classic?
I would say there's some similarities. The obvious difference is, you know, with the Derby, with each individual horse, you only get one shot at it. So there's no second chances. And, you know, not that you run very many horses multiple times in the Breeders' Cup Classic, but, you know, there is that opportunity to come back and try it again with the same horse. So, you know, a little bit different in that way. And, you know, the other thing that I think is different about the Derby as opposed to any of the Breeders' Cup races is just, you know, the build up to the Derby, I don't think there's anything quite like it in racing. And there's, you know, at the end of the day, there's at the most 20 participants. And so there's just so much, you know, coverage on each individual participant where when you get to the Breeders' Cup, you know, generally there's what, 180 plus horses running and just so many different storylines going on that sort of the attention is spread out so much more. But the Breeders' Cup Classic being, you know, the pinnacle of sort of the championship day of racing, it was a race that you know, our team really wanted to win, and certainly one of the races that I think if you ask any trainer, you know, of the wish list of races that they wanted to win, it's way, way up there. It was great for Vino Rosso and great for his ownership group and their families and, you know, and our team as well. It was a fun, fun win for us and a very, very satisfying and gratifying one. And we enjoyed the heck out of it. Mm.
Todd, it's Bill Finley. Thanks for joining us. And a lot was made Breeders' Cup week of the track condition. It was very deep, tiring, very slow times. Some trainers, including Shug McGahee, thought that it really compromised their horse's chances. Shug McGahee, of course, with Code of Honor. Your take on the track, and why did Vino Rosso perhaps really relish it while some horses didn't?
Well, I mean, I think it was hard for me to tell if there was a difference on the track Saturday versus Friday. I thought that the track on Friday appeared to be incredibly slow. And, you know, anytime you see horses, you know, juveniles, high quality horses like that running in as slow at times as they did, it seemed to, you know, to be a little bit too slow to me. And I know obviously everyone was trying to do everything they could to make the conditions as safe as possible. I'm not convinced that having a deep, slow, tiring track is necessarily more safe than having a hard, firm type of surface. But you know, there might have been a bit of an adjustment to Saturday. It seemed like the times were a bit faster, but, you know, they were also probably higher quality horses running on Saturday, at least older, more mature horses running on Saturday. But still, it was a bit of a slow track and certainly a very demanding track. I think the reason why Vino Rosso did so well on it is just a big, powerful, strong horse with a big stride that is capable of pushing his way through that type of surface and actually relished it. And, being a true mile and a quarter horse, I think it played in his favor. And we sort of saw that when we took him out for the Santa Anita Gold Cup in May that. That he liked it out there. I'm not sure it was quite as deep back in May, but it was still deep at that time. And he took to it, and that kind of gave us added confidence that he'd hopefully take to it again.
Just a quick follow-up on that is Joe Bianca again. It's interesting that you said that a slower track doesn't necessarily equate to a safer track. What factors do you think go into making a racetrack safer?
Well, I mean, I think it's that's a very complicated question. It starts at the base and works its way up through the cushion and the amount of moisture that's on it, the depth of the cushion and all of those things. And, I mean, we've seen it on a number of occasions on big days where they'll really tighten the track up. And I don't think that's the way to go, but I think, if you can keep it as consistent as possible, that's probably the safest way. I think horses will a lot of times adapt to the way it is, but if it's continually changing from day to day, to me, that's when you sometimes get in trouble. But, there's probably a happy medium there between too hard, too fast, and too deep, too slow. So, to me, you want to get in the middle there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Todd, Alan Carrasco, and thanks for being with us. I'm curious, in your mind, when did the penny drop, so to speak, for Vino Rosso? Even as recently as the Whitney ran well that day, but certainly not a race that would suggest that he was up to this. But when do you think the light bulb really went on for him?
We saw a big difference from the beginning of this year. And, one of the things we talked about back to even when he was a 2-year-old and he was able to win his first couple of starts, we'd always said this horse should, based on his pedigree and his physical development, should be a better 4-year-old than he is a 3-year-old and certainly a 2-year-old. I think it was a combination of just natural physical maturity and I think part of it also was us sort of figuring him out. The one thing that became obvious to us after the Whitney is he didn't love Saratoga, and he ran some okay races there, but not to what we felt like were his true capabilities. And looking back at it now, if you kind of take Tampa Bay Downs and Saratoga off his resumes, pretty much ran great every other time at other tracks. So that's why we ultimately decided not to go in the Woodward and wait for the Jockey Club. And we knew like the mile and a quarter, we felt like he liked Belmont more than he did Saratoga. And certainly, at least off the one race, he seemed to really like Santa Anita.
Todd, Bill Finley again. You just mentioned the Gold Cup, and you're not somebody who ever gets bitter or anything like that. But nonetheless, it's a pretty controversial DQ. My opinion, which doesn't count for anything, was that you got robbed. The horse should not have come down. But considering that was the prelude to the Breeders' Cup Classic, was this win maybe a little more sweet that you got vindication for a controversial DQ in the Jockey Club Gold Cup?
I got to be honest with you, no. Okay. I mean, we winning the Breeders' Cup Classic was phenomenal on its own. I totally agree with you. I thought it was a horrible decision, and I would have said that if I trained Code of Honor, to be right. honest with you. And I never like to win when I, get put up when you finish second. And, I just, to me, it didn't, none of the general views that you look at for disqualifying a horse happened that day. No one stopped riding. No one altered course. No one steadied. In my opinion, no one was cost a position. So, look, still think it's a bad call. Nothing we can do about it. And it's one of those things you move on. And it was fantastic to win the Breeders' Cup. I still think, for the horse that not being awarded the win in the Jockey Club was not fair to him, but he certainly made up for it in the dominant performance in the Breeders' Cup.
This is Alan Carrasco again. Your relationship with Jimmy Kruppi, this horse was picked out by Jimmy Kruppi by a Breeders' Cup Classic winner out of a dam by Street Cry, who, of course, was a sire of Zenyatta, another Breeders' Cup Classic winner. But could you just reflect on your relationship with Jimmy Kruppi?
Yeah, I mean, I got to know Jimmy really well, over the last, 12 years or so. And, you know, part of a big part of that was his relationship with Mike Rapoli and Denny Viola, and, you know, kind of going back to Uncle Mo and when he purchased him, and we saw him in his early preparation there. And, you know, he's a big part of the team, big part of the reason that Rapoli stable and Viola's have had a lot of success. And, you know, he's responsible for not only selecting those horses, but doing their early preparation. He's a great guy, fun guy to be around, you know, a great character. And so sad, we'll all certainly miss him and miss him being a big part of the team. At the same time, it was fantastic that he was given a lot of credit for it and acknowledged in the telecast. And, so it's sort of bittersweet for all that.
I just wanted to go back to that DQ real quick, because I think we were in unanimous agreement with you that it was a terrible call. Did you ever get an explanation from the stewards for that? What did they say, if so?
I tried to get an explanation, but, they felt like that, I guess, Ired moved out and bumped into the other horse. I certainly agree that they came together and they brushed. I thought he came out a little bit. I think Code of Honor came in a little bit. And like I said, no one altered course, no one steadied, no one took up, no one stopped riding. So for any race, in my opinion, it was minimal contact. And certainly for a race like that, where two horses had, you know, a quarter of a mile to throw it down head and head. And, you know, it seemed to me like the best horse in the end won and was starting to pull away at the end. Mm-hmm. To be honest, they never really gave me what I consider to be a satisfactory answer anyways.
Gotcha.
Todd, we have to bring up the elephant in the room, and it's an uncomfortable thing to discuss, but, you know, you are one of the faces of the industry. So if you were to read the newspaper coverage and TV coverage, not from the TDN and Blood Horse and Daily Racing Form, but from the mainstream media, it was all about Mongolian Groom, and Vino Rosso was barely mentioned in the coverage. What to you, as one of the leaders of this industry, and again, one of the faces of the industry, and, you know, no one has demanded that you be a spokesman for the sport, but you're an articulate guy, and again, you know, one of the faces of the sport. What do you say to racing's critics in light of the Mongolian Groom fatality?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any, you know, acceptable answer. And the reality is we have to do better. And, you know, we have to do better starting from the birth of these horses. And, you know, I think a lot of the issues are sort of pointed towards the racetrack and pointed towards the trainers and that aspect. But, you know, I think the more we look at it, that these situations can begin back at, you know, literally at the birth of these foals, and, you know, how they're prepped, how they're treated and presented at yearling sales and two-year-old training sales. So we have to do better in every single phase. And, you know, I think we all know that there's certainly nothing we can do that is absolutely going to prevent it from happening. But I do think we can dramatically reduce it, and every effort has to be made to do that. And, you know, I think we've made some strides in the right direction, but we gotta, you know, we can't back off now. We gotta continue to work harder and do better at this. And it's a crisis. And, you know, I think as in racing, a lot of times we get through one crisis and then we kind of coast. We can't let our foot off the pedal here. We gotta get this thing sorted out, and we gotta do a hell of a lot better than we're doing right now.
All right, Todd. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Todd. Great stuff.
Good
great
luck,
stuff.
Man.
All right, guys. Thank you. Appreciate
it. See ya.
Thanks.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As The Green Group Guest of the Week, Todd Pletcher will receive a one-hour free tax consultation. The Green Group, bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com, www.greenco.com. So we'll start with the Breeders' Cup recap. It's going to be the bulk of the show, obviously. I guess the main story coming out of it is Bricks and Mortar, because kind of by attrition, Midnight Bizou losing, I think he became the Omaha Beach losing, Code of Honor losing, like these other big name horses going down. And Bricks and Mortar, I was watching that race, and on the far turn, I didn't think he was traveling that well. Now, maybe in retrospect, it was because he was stuck in between horses, because at the top of the stretch, the Red Sea kind of parted for him. All the horses in front of him moved over to the rail. And then once he got in the clear, I thought he really exploded. And he's just a really remarkable horse. I kind of roll my eyes when people say, oh, this horse knows where the wire is. Well, no, they don't. The horses have no idea where the wire is. Like, I can't even see it when I'm at the track. So the horses have no idea. But he is one of those horses that I think knows innately how and when to turn it on. And it's just a remarkable picture of consistency. And especially with all the physical issues that he had going back to 2017, for him to make it back and have this kind of campaign, I don't think there's anybody in the industry that can have a real beef with him being the horse of the year.
Totally agree. We would like horse of the year. It's sexier. It's makes better headlines when it's a Justify and American Pharoah. We look for horse of the year to come out of what is still the premier type of racing we have in this country, dirt racing for males, be it three-year-olds or older horses. There was nobody that even came close to filling the bill among those groups. So then by default, you look at other divisions. And we said on the show in the weeks prior to it, pretty much, I think everybody was in agreement, it looked like going into the Breeders' Cup was more or less a two-horse race for Horse of the Year. Midnight Bisou and Bricks and Mortar, both undefeated. If both win, we've got a difficult choice. If one or the other wins, it's not a difficult choice. This horse, what more do you want him to do? I mean, I wish he won, ran 15 times, but that doesn't happen anymore. He only ran six. He won all six. Midnight Bisou did not. Matoli did not win all his races. He suffered one loss. It's a deserving horse of the year. And, you know, again, maybe 20 years from now, we'll look back and, you know, we won't remember him in the same breath of some of the horses I just mentioned. Just like a Côte-de-Chien many years ago, a turf horse that won Horse of the Year. But I think this is a better horse than mm-hmm. Côte-de-Chien. He did what he had to do. He showed up on Breeders' Cup Day, and the other contenders did not. So, you know, show up, Chad, get your tuxedo out, and Seth Clarman and Bill Lawrence, get your tuxedo out. You got a big trophy coming your way. Congratulations.
I don't know how much we want to bleed into topic number two here on this little sheet of paper, but I do think Matoli entered the discussion at a bare minimum. And it's interesting. I mean, the two horses that had historical campaigns, I mean, Bricks and Mortar won five grade one races from 9 furlongs up to 12, two at 10 furlongs, one at mile and 3/16 for good measure. Matoli had a grade one at 6 on the weekend, had two at 7/8 and had them at mile. So, I mean, they're two very, very good horses that had really, really strong campaigns. You know, if you ask me right here, right now, I would be in the undecided category for Horse of the Year. So
let's get it on. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, Alan, you know, that's fine. To me, the stamp of undefeated versus not undefeated, and I agree with you. I mean, take nothing away. Well, Matoli was fantastic. And if he did not have that one poor performance in the Alfred Vanderbilt, I would be in that same camp, undecided. I don't know what I would do, but you know, for one horse to be undefeated versus the other one not to be undefeated, I think that's a no-brainer. I really do. And that's no slight on Matoli. I totally agree with you. He had a great year, but he didn't accomplish what Bricks and Mortar did, finishing year as year undefeated. It's, to me, it's very simple.
Yeah, I guess in my mind, it's going to come down to a decision. I'm going to lay each horse side by side. I'm going to look at the competition that they faced. I'm going to make a judgment call on which division I thought was stronger top to bottom, the quality of horses that that Matoli and Bricks and Mortar beat, and then make a decision. So I haven't decided one way or the other just yet. I wouldn't even say I have a leaning one way or the other, but I do think Matoli's in the discussion.
I don't disagree with that in the discussion, but you know, when my ballot is in, I'm not going to hesitate for a second. So
as the number one Matoli fan club cheerleader, I'm with you on that, Al. I think overall the competition he faced was better than the competition Bricks and Mortar faced. But I do think that Bill is right, that it's not as sexy as going undefeated. So I think in the end, that's the thing that'll tip the scales in Bricks and Mortar's favor. But yeah, I mean, Matoli, he really showed up to every big sprint race and also the Met Mile and beat quality horses. And I think he's obviously going to win Sprinter of the Year. Who's going to beat him for older dirt male? Like, I mean, Vino Rosso obviously had that great performance. I think if he hadn't gotten DQ'd in the Jockey Club Gold Cup, maybe he'd have a better argument. But I think Matoli should be older dirt male and sprinter of the year.
Well, you know, again, I want to preface this again by saying no knock on Mattioli, and I think you guys are making a good argument for him, but you know, that would be like voting for a Democrat in Mississippi. You ain't gonna win, pal.
He's not. Democrat just won Kentucky last night, so you never know.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. He's not going to win.
Yeah.
He's just not. It's there's no suspense to this. And, you know, at the end of the day, you could vote for Mattioli all you want. And you make, you know, it's not a vote I would criticize like some other, you know, horse of the year votes over the years for people that I thought were asinine. But you're not winning. It's just bricks and mortar horse of the year.
Yeah. I mean, it goes to show you the effect of one race that we're not even discussing. Midnight Bizou now. She's completely tossed out. And I just wanted to mention that race real quick because that seemed like a real rider's race. And I kind of get kind of mad at Joe Bravo sometimes because he does make these big slingshot wide moves on the turn and I see him flatten out a lot. But that was 1,000% the right thing to do in this race. He saw Midnight Bizou bogged down on the inside, probably the deeper part of the track. And he said, screw it, I'm going for it right now. And Blue Prize had this huge run on the turn. Thought she might flatten out a little bit late, but she's obviously primed, ready to go, and was able to hold on. No. Discredit to Midnight Bizou. I thought she still put in a pretty stout late run and just couldn't get to the horse that had maybe like a 16th of a mile jump on her on the turn.
Well, didn't Midnight Bizou and Omaha Beach get essentially the same ride from Mike Smith? You know, the same race.
Very bad
one. Now, okay, well, save that thought. Because, yeah, I wouldn't say they were good rides. I don't know if they were bad rides because you don't know how much of it was the horse. The horse just, you know, was spinning its wheels on the deep track, didn't want to get into it. But certainly they were identical rides. I mean, you could just look at both races and you know, if you etched out the silks and didn't know who the horses were, you couldn't tell one from the other. He left both horses with too much to do, no doubt about it. Now, is that his fault or the horse's fault, Alan?
Wow.
Thanks, Bill. Come on. That's why you make the big bucks here, you know.
I was somewhat surprised to see Mandel go on record saying that maybe Omaha bounced a little bit off of the sprint return. I just thought positionally, and there was a few other factors as well, but I thought positionally that Mike had Omaha Beach way, way too far back. Also, I thought the complexion of the race changed when horses like Diamond Oops and Snapper Sinclair didn't go for the lead, leaving Spun to Run out there by his lonesome. So in addition to being too far back, there was lone speed. Not that he had it easy with Blue Chipper out there. I'm going to take a little credit for Blue Chipper, who I said.
How about that?
He ran well, yep.
A couple weeks ago, I said that, yeah. You know, that he probably was not a win candidate, but that he'd go out there and give an honest account of himself, and that he did. And really, interestingly, given the track surfaces back home, he may have been one that benefited most mm-hmm. from that underfoot, from those underfoot conditions on the weekend. So, in any event, to answer your question, Bill, I think it's more the rides than it was the horses.
I think it exemplifies how well Blue Prize won that nobody else really closed on that day. It was a really tiring track, and I did a story last week on Blue Prize, and I try to always bet the horses that I do stories on. So I did better a little bit, but I didn't better as hard as I wanted to because, first of all, the wide post. But secondly, I thought she was going to be too far back. And obviously, the pace was pretty quick. Shout out to Serengeti Empress, who I thought ran great to be third in there. And I think she's a really interesting horse going forward, about that 7 furlong to a mile distance. But yeah, they ran against the grain of the track, I think. And Blue Prize being that far back and winning. And even Midnight Bizou, who was, and she was mid-pack, she wasn't as far back, but I thought she ran well from off the pace. So I think they ran against the grain of the track. And I think Blue Prize, honestly, was, to me, the most impressive winner on the card, her and Mattioli.
Yeah, I mean, I would toss Uni in there. And the mile is one of the more frustrating races on the day for me. I couldn't get anything right all weekend in the way that I mapped the races out in my head. And I felt good when Bolo came out Saturday morning because I felt that Hake Gammon from the 13 hole, I thought he was going to get out there and be able to control things. And then your friend El Tormenta came up and was the tormentor. just wouldn't let Hake Gammon, just wouldn't leave him alone.
Yeah.
And so a pace that looked like it was going to have no pace on, mm-hmm. on paper ends up boiling over. And I should have stuck to my guns. About 3 weeks ago on the show, I said if Uni ran her race that she ran in the First Lady, she wasn't going to lose. but didn't stick with that.
That's a good segue into our next topic. I was going to bring up the mile and just how cool it is to see the two mares duking it out down the stretch. And I hope that that gives more people confidence to try their female horses against the boys. You know, Wesley Ward has been willing to do it for a long time. And it's, if you got a horse fast enough and it's a bigger purse, just go for it. I mean, Mark Cassidy did it twice this year with God Stormy. It paid off in the four-star Dave, and then she ran second the other day in the mile. So I got to give those guys a lot of credit for stepping out a little bit. And Uni was just, she's just a monster. She's just so much fun to watch, that late kick.
2 points there. First of all, I totally agree with you, and I've been saying this for 25 years, that, you know, you see horses like in Europe and Aidan O'Brien, they don't think twice about Enable,
right?
You know, about running against males. It's if they're good enough, they're just good enough. And we don't do nearly enough of that. And I hope the example set by Cassie and Chad Brown with these horses will lead others to try it, because it's fun. It's really fun for mm-hmm. racing. But I thought kind of the takeaway from that race is very interesting. You know, we love to think about and mull who will win the various divisional titles. Sister Charlie, if I were to give you 1 to 5 on Saturday morning that Sister Charlie was going to be the Filly and Mare Turf champion, you would have taken that bet. Because first of all, you think she's going to win the Filly and Mare Turf. And you also don't say, well, even if she doesn't, who's going to unseat this horse? Who but Chad Brown could beat his own horse out for Filly and Mare Turf champion? I think that she's got to be, because, you know, the body of work this year is very similar up to the Breeders' Cup, and Uni won it against males, and Sister Charlie failed to win against females. So, Peter Brandt, Chad Brown cost you an Eclipse Award, my friend. And, you know, the hardware, I think, well, you know, I'll throw this out. Do you think the voters will agree with me?
I think
it's a pretty, you know, I mean, interesting case.
Uni definitely finished stronger than Sister Charlie. The funny thing about the Sister Charlie race was that they scratched Thais. Because, I mean, the California vet scratched her, and that was supposed to be the rabbit for Sister Charlie. And then he gets a rabbit anyway.
Yeah, that's that other horse. I don't even remember the name of the horse.
Murph.
Went out there and went 22 flat, 44, yeah. Been led by 20 lengths or whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
what was that all
that's
about?
The world of Chad Brown. They scratch his rabbit, and someone else just takes its place. So I would say, yeah, Uni definitely finished stronger, I would say. And she was phenomenal in the First Lady, phenomenal in the Breeders' Cup Mile. But the rest of the campaign, I don't know. I don't know if the rest of the campaign does it for me. She was a beaten favorite in the four-star Dave. I think she ran once before that in the race at Belmont won easily. But and I didn't love Sister Charlie's Flower Bowl, and then she ran third the other day. But I think the body of work, you still got to give it to Sister Charlie.
Nah, you're totally wrong. not even close.
I tweeted it after the race, and I actually had somebody whose opinion I respect very much come back and say God Stormy had the better campaign between her and Uni, which I don't agree with.
Yeah.
For me, Uni is a no-brainer for me.
Yeah, really? Joe, the thing I would
say— slaves of the moment.
But look, I mean, it's not the be-all and end-all when it comes to deciding Eclipse Awards. However, the Breeders' Cup is still considered a championship event. Now, you know, I know we're going to get into the just— you know, cluster, you know what, of the two-year-old division and how nobody deserves to be an Eclipse Award winner. But, you know, the winning on the championship day, you know, when I decide my Eclipse Award votes, I don't even look at grade twos. I just look at grade ones. And I consider the Breeders' Cup like a grade one plus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having won in a championship environment, quote-unquote championship race, that to me puts her above Sister Charlie. And again, you know, is Sister Charlie a horrible selection for, you know, that division? No, but it's not the right selection.
I just think the best horse that Sister Charlie beat this year, well, I was going to say Rushing Fall was the best horse that she beat. I mean, maybe there's an argument that Magic Wand is the best horse that she beat. I just feel like for Uni to show up on the day on Saturday and beat that field— which admittedly is probably not the greatest field ever assembled for the mile, but to do it, I thought she did it with a fair bit of authority. To me, she's done enough.
Before we move on from the mile, just one little hypothetical I wanted to throw out there, because Chad was deciding between the turf and the mile for Bricks and Mortar. You guys think Bricks and Mortar would have won the mile?
Yeah.
Really?
Why not? Why not? He's because he's the best. He's good. Because I mean, you know, it's that simple.
Well, it's the same. The reason I bring it up is because when we were talking about before, I thought the turf was the right selection because he does have that kind of grinding, stalking style, whereas Uni has that huge late punch. I don't know. I feel like she would have passed him over the top.
It could have been. But, you know, in the end, he made the right choice.
So. Yeah.
I would have gone for her in that race. I just think she's got a more lethal turn of foot. His turn of foot is good, but you're right. He's more of a grinder.
Yeah.
And I think she would have got home faster.
Yeah. So, of course, Chad made the right decision in both instances. We're going to go back to Friday for a second. First thing, American Pharoah did not take long to get his first Breeders' Cup win in the juvenile turf sprint with four-wheel drive, who I thought was really impressive. And then also ran third with John Green's Another Miracle, who was terrific in there. And so I think there were three American Pharoahs in the Breeders' Cup. They all hit the board. That was the first thing I noticed. The other thing was the juvenile, and that was the big story coming out of Friday. Changed. Not only did the race change, but the Eclipse Award picture changed 1 second out of the gate when Dennis's moment went to his face and then just kind of jogged around the track at the back of the pack. I want to know if you guys would automatically give the Eclipse to Storm the Court because it was a championship race and because he did win the most important race, but he's done nothing else. I don't think he's going to do anything else the rest of the year. Let's say a horse like Dennis's moment comes back and wins the Kentucky Jockey Club by 5 lengths or so. Do you think this is an automatic Eclipse Award for Storm the Court?
I personally don't. I'm going to be watching, I mean, speaking of grade twos, I'll be watching the Kentucky Jockey Club with interest. We'll see how Tis Law does in there.
We got the Remsen, I mean, too.
And the Remsen.
Yeah.
And that horse was super impressive the other day in the Nashua. So that'll be an interesting race, too. But, I mean, if I were the connections of Storm the Court, there's no way in the world I would not be running in the Los Al Futurity.
I believe that's not a grade one anymore, though. I believe it's downgraded to two.
Okay, I'll look it up.
Which would make a difference. And not that I disagree with you. I don't believe, if I'm right about that, there's no grade one races left on the calendar for two-year-olds. So, you know, then you have to, I know where you're going with this, Alan, but then you have to dig down and say, okay, how much weight do I give a win in a grade two like the Remsen? Right. And, you know, this year it probably is relevant because this is a very, you know, after I just made that speech about how everything comes down to the Breeders' Cup championship event, I would have a very hard time voting for this horse. I mean, I just don't think he's that good. You know, it was a fluky race. You know, the favorite stumbled at the start. If you put a gun to my head, I have no idea who to vote for.
Yeah, I feel like this is kind of the only division that still remains up in the air. I feel like everything else was decided over the weekend. The horse that Al was talking about, Independence Hall in the Nashua, got a 101 buyer, another monster son of Constitution. Color me shocked. So as he continues his first crowd
dominance. Did you figure out the Los Al race is a grade
two? It is. Yeah, you're correct. Okay. It has been downgraded to a grade two, which makes sense. Like, it hardly ever gets, I mean, it'll get usually one big Baffert horse and then nobody else.
Yeah.
So any other thoughts on Friday or the juvenile?
You know, just say, even if it's a grade two, say Baffert decided to throw 8 rings in there. Storm the Court is in there and beats 8 rings. To me, he's definitely strengthened his argument. Mm-hmm.
Anybody like Structor going forward as a Derby candidate?
I don't.
The grass horse?
Why not? Chad talked about it. Yeah.
Oh, he's definitely. I talked to him the other day. He's on the road to the Derby.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He says as long as, you know, he sees in the mornings the way the horse is training on the dirt. But, you know, for him to immediately say that after the race, mm-hmm. he already knows his horse can handle the dirt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's no killer. His Byron number was very slow. I don't remember what
it was. Got a great trip, too.
Yeah. You know, of all the two-year-olds coming out of that day, you know, with Dennis's moment being an unknown, you know, I would look at this horse as, and I'm not that high on him, but I would say, you know, he's the most interesting horse to come out of the day because you have this, you know, such a successful trainer, you know, saying I'm converting this grass horse to dirt. And, you know, we know the guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah, but he hasn't done this yet. So well, that's what makes it interesting.
Would you put anything past him?
Absolutely not. But,
you know, if he had a Lipizzan, you know, going in the Florida Derby or something, I'd have to look second at the, you know, give the horse a chance. I'm sorry.
All right, Barbara was a turf horse, obviously, but prior to being switched. I think Palace Malice being by Curlin, he's going to get dirt runners. I mean, this makes every bit of sense to me in the world. Anyway, how about this, that you had two Belmont winning sires that had Breeders' Cup winners on the grass? from the first crop.
Yeah. I mean, American Pharoah right now looks like this huge grass sire.
That's the amazing thing. Who would have figured that? Yeah, he has four stakes winners. All of them are on the turf. I think the only horse who's even black tie placed is that American Theorem, who was second in the American Pharoah.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on the Breeders' Cup before we move on to the tragedy of the Breeders' Cup? This was really, really unfortunate. I was watching these races from the press box mostly, and I think everybody was on eggshells all weekend. And every time I saw a race finished, I was counting the horses that crossed the wire because I was just, please, please, nobody pull up, nobody break down. And I think Santa Anita did everything they could. I know we talked to Todd Pletcher, and he said that a slower track doesn't necessarily equate to a safer track, which I think makes sense. But I think in terms of the equine inspection and the track, I think they did what they thought was best. And it seemed like it worked through that the entire week. No incidents Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then, of course, 3/16 of a mile before the finish of the Classic, Mongolian Groom broke down and unfortunately had to be put down later on. And it just cast a pall over what otherwise I thought was a really successful, really fun event with a lot of great performances. And it just it continues this theme that it doesn't seem like racing can catch a break. You know, I'm of two minds of this thing where I think racing is getting a comeuppance that it has deserved for a long time for not putting equine safety at the top, the very top of the priorities list. But at the same time, it's not the picture being painted in the media now is not accurate. And I think it's unfortunate at Santa Anita, especially, that we had this great backdrop and everything was going so smoothly. And now we have the 37th fatality. And that's the problem, is that this has been such a huge news story and such an optics disaster that now we have a counter. Now, I can't say that Santa Anita is any more dangerous than any other track in America right now, but the public thinks it is, and the public has a counter on how many fatalities the track has had, and that's why I was critical of keeping the Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita, and I continue to be. You know, I'm not saying that Santa Anita is any less safe than any other track, but this is an optics crisis, and the public didn't know anything other than there were dead horses in the news at Santa Anita for months at a time. This is not anything against Santa Anita. I think they've done everything right in reaction to this problem, but this is why I was critical about the Breeders' Cup running the races at Santa Anita. Like, what is their explanation? And it just it came out in the most tragic way possible, and just crushing for it to be at the end after such a great weekend.
Well, first of all, I echo everything you said, with the exception of I was in favor of the race sustained at Santa Anita. But, you know, that's really neither here nor there, because this is not a time to point fingers. And not that you did. And I also agree that Santa Anita, the Stronach Group, California Horse Racing Board, Breeders' Cup, what more could they have done? My goodness, you know, 30 vets out there and checking every horse up and down. And I totally agree with you, too, that it's, you know, it's almost like the sport is cursed. You know, they get, not only did this happen, it happened, you know, like with this cruel tease of getting, like you said, 3/16 of a mile to the finish of the very last race of the day. But in our interview with Todd Pletcher, I mentioned this. I took a chance to read the mainstream, and I don't want to sound like Trump or something like that, but you know, the coverage you're going to get in a publication like the Thoroughbred Daily News is very different than what you're going to get in the Los Angeles Times, mm-hmm. New York Times, etc. There was barely even mention of Vino Rosa or Bricks and Mortar or anything. It was just another death at Santa Anita. The problem racing faces here, to me, is that the cat is now out of the bag. The general public really wasn't aware of how dangerous this sport is. And now, because of the media and because of the hyper-focus on the deaths at Santa Anita, not only is the public aware of it, but it's being shoved down their throat day after day after day after day, death after death after death. What I fear is that even if we can do everything we can like Santa Anita did, will the general public accept any deaths? The problem and I'm not sure they will. And you know, the best case scenario, that number that's out there, 1.64 deaths per 1,000 starters, let's suppose we cut that in half, which would be a Herculean task to get it in half. Would the public still say, that's not good enough? And, you know, we're going to find out, unfortunately. You know, we haven't heard the last of this. We've heard from Dianne Feinstein, who basically has said, you know, end the sport now. But she has no authority to end the sport. She's a U.S. senator. There's nothing she can do on a state level.
Gavin Newsom does, though.
Yeah, that's what I worry about. As we speak today, we have not heard from Gavin Newsom yet. I think we're going to hear from him, and I think we're going to hear something that is going to be very troubling for the sport of horse racing. And, you know, God forbid, we don't know where this is going to go, but I fear the worst case scenario. And, you know, again, when I talk to this among friends and other people in the industry, I preface by saying, I hate to be the voice of doom and gloom, but how can you not
be? It's hard not to be right now.
And you have to be realistic about this too. You know, you can't bury your heads in the sand anymore. And I agree with you. I'm taking up way too much time here, Joe, but I agree with exactly what you said. You know, I hate that this has happened to racing, but you know what? If we started doing the things that we're doing now 10, 15 years ago, and not just passing the buck, not just putting our heads in sand and just not hoping, oh, it's going to blow over, then maybe we wouldn't be in this predicament we are today.
Yeah, I think Todd was, one thing interesting that he said was that as soon as horse racing goes through a good patch or several weeks or a couple months with no incidents, there seems to be this complacency that this false sense of security that things are better or solved or on the improve, and it just takes something like this to bring it back down to earth. I mean, the reality is obviously zero deaths at the racetrack is not something that's achievable. And you're right, Bill. Is even one death out of 1,000, is that something that is going to be acceptable?
No, and that's the big question. And let's again suppose that, you know, when Santa Anita reopens in December, that they have a wonderful safety record. I mean, beyond what anybody could imagine. But let's say there's two deaths at that meet, which would be a number so off the charts good compared to what we've come to expect from horse racing. But when that first horse dies, it's going to be front page news in Los Angeles Times. It's going to be on every TV station in Los Angeles, and it's probably going to get a lot of weight in the national media as well. Another horse dies at Santa Anita. And nobody's going to say, oh, but look, they've only had two this meet. Isn't that wonderful? They're going to say another horse dies at Santa Anita. And that's going to be the be-all and end-all of that story.
Well, because the narrative has already been shaped, and they already had that epidemic that they were slow to react to. They did eventually react to it, and I think have done a great job since. But what was it, like a couple dozen horses before it started to subside a little bit? And they've let the narrative be shaped by the animal rights extremists. You know, I don't know that if you go to another track and you start counting the deaths, I don't know that that number is going to be much different than it is at Santa Anita. But now this number is burned into people's brains that 36 horses have died at Santa Anita. And it's not something that racing is going to easily overcome, or Santa Anita is going to easily overcome. And I think you're right that there is a question over whether or not there is an acceptable level of catastrophic fatalities in racing. And I don't know the answer to that. But what I will say is that we need a better front. We need a better argument for what racing does for horses too, you know, because animals are domesticated and have jobs all over the world. And 99% of them are treated a lot worse than racehorses. You know, you want to talk about the beef industry or any of this other stuff, that racing gives these horses a job. Horses need a job. They've needed it for hundreds of years, and they run. Like, that's what they naturally do. You know, you let them out in the field and they run. And obviously racing is different than running in the field, but as far as the life you can give a domesticated animal, racehorses have it pretty damn good. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do better by them. And I just, as I said earlier, you know, we have not done a good enough job on equine safety as an industry going back decades. But to tell the positive side of the story, like, my girlfriend is not a racing fan. She gets into it to support me, and she's been out to the track with me dozens and dozens of times. And I'm like, have you ever seen any of this negative stuff that PETA's talking about all the time? And she's like, no, it's always beautiful. I always have a great time. So, I mean, that's a sample size thing, but she's seen the positive side of it. And I think that so many people that have made up their mind about racing and about Santa Anita have not seen that positive side of it and had not heard that positive argument from racing people.
Joe, again, I couldn't agree more, but I'm going to take this discussion and put it in a little bit different direction. What is sobering about the problem is that if we have three people in this room here, you know, I'm just starting to suppose there's 200,000 people. I mean, I have no idea, that work in horse racing in the United States of America. If I got any one of those 200,000 people, they would agree with you. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I would imagine Alan agrees with you. But the thing that racing has to realize is our opinion doesn't matter, mm-hmm. because we're the insiders. And this issue is not going to be decided by Joe Bianca, Alan Carrasso, Bill Finley, Elliot Walden, Bob Baffert, Todd Pletcher, Craig Fravel, Rick Bedecker, whomever. It's going to be decided by the man on the street. And you're right. Racing has not had a narrative to combat what the animal rights people are saying. But if people in racing want to sit back and say, hey, this is all BS and the animals are treated great and, you know, it's something that just happens. And examples you put about, you know, the slaughter of cows for beef and stuff like that. You know what? Doesn't matter. Does not matter what we think. And, you know, that's why I think a lot of people are feeling fairly helpless right now.
I think, to your point, the reason that people think about it differently is a lot of people think about the beef industry and all this stuff as a necessity. And I don't think that people think of racing as a necessity. They think of it as entertainment, that they're forcing these horses to go through for entertainment and for economic value. And I really don't think that's the case most of the time. It is some of the time, too much of the time, and we should do better about that. But I don't think that's the case overall. And it's just now the narrative is so ingrained in the public after this past year that it's hard for me to see a way back.
Well, and I'll throw one more thing out there. Dog racing.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, where are you going to find a dog track? Was it like 3 or 4 left in the country or something like that? Can racing go down that route? Geez, I hope not. But, you know, there's a blueprint out there for basically wiping out an entire sport because of dog racing had severe problems with the animal rights people and they put out of business. So, you know,
there's two main differences I would bring up is that I think racing is more spread out and ingrained in American culture. It's in a lot more different states. And the second thing is, as we know, there's a lot of big money in racing. And I think part of the problem with dog racing is they didn't have necessarily the funds to counteract that activism that was coming their way. And I think that's kind of why it died out. I think racing, there's a ton of money to put up that fight. And it's just, we got to put up a better fight, guys. I mean, whether it's PR campaigns or, I don't know, we got to do better at telling our side of the story. And I did a story last week at the Breeders' Cup with Doug O'Neill, who has kind of, and we talked about this before in the podcast, has organized these counter rallies. And to their credit, when I went to Santa Anita on Saturday, I didn't see many protesters. I saw a lot of counter protesters, like the "this is horse racing people" and "this is my job, this is my passion." So I think the people with the boots on the ground are doing it real well, but it's just got to be an industry-wide effort.
No disagreement here, Joe.
So this past week was, I think, the most difficult week in the history of the Thoroughbred Daily News. Our news editor, Ben Massam, who was dearly close to pretty much everybody in the office, one of the best guys that you'll ever meet. He had been dealing with a battle with cancer for the better part of the last year. And unfortunately, Friday night, we lost him. And it was really tough for all of us. And it's just kind of a hole that's never going to be filled at the TDN. And Alan Carrasso has written a dedication, and we'd like to dedicate this podcast and really all future podcasts and so much of our work here at the TDN to Ben. Go ahead, Al.
You know, our family just took a tremendous and terrific loss with Ben's passing. You know, as you've read over the last several days in the paper, in our tributes and personal recollections, it's not only that Ben was a terrific teammate and, by all accounts, a brilliant rider. More than that, he was just a great human being. And like Joe said, we're dedicating this Writer's Room podcast to Ben's memory. We continue to extend our condolences to Ben's father, Brad, and his wife, Barbara, and really to anyone that Ben touched in any small way. We're going to miss him dearly. It's always going to be in our thoughts.
And yeah. Ben was the best of us, I think, in so many ways, and it doesn't make any sense to me how this could happen to someone like him, but I think the way that we honor him and his legacy is to try to be more like him, and by being kinder to each other and to the rest of the world, and to make sure the positive impact he had on all of us unmistakably when he was here lives on. So we miss you, buddy. There's definitely a hole in our hearts, and wish he could still be with us. So on that note, we're going to sign off for this week. We want to thank Todd Pletcher, our Green Group guest of the week. I also want to thank Bill Finley and Alan Carrasso, and thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you next week.